Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix with Rod Bryant and Jerry Gordon here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the Matrix.
And since you hear my voice, you know that you are already beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Jerry and I come on and do the show today with heavy hearts because of the death of our co-worker and dear friend, Ari Fuld. Cool. And I'm just, man, it's been a tough week. It's been a tough week. But at the same time, you and I are hoping and praying that positive things come out of this, and that there will be other strong lions of Judah that will step up in his place to do the work.
I think the thing that most impressed upon me was that Fuld, as an American Olim and a member of a...
Explain that to the listener, just in case they don't know who this, what it is.
Essentially, this is an immigrant.
Right.
To Israel from the Galut, to the right. Diaspora, right. As some Israelis castically call it. Mm-hmm. He was an American Olim who was fully an Israeli citizen. He was a member of the IDF. He was a reservist. But most importantly and prominently, as a 45-year-old father of four beautiful children, mm-hmm. he was a defender of Israel. He was prominent on social media. He would contest the opposition, whether it was Palestinian or, shall we say, nefarious Jews
right.
in this world. He was a valiant knight hero for Israel and the Jewish world, as far as
absolutely.
Many of us are concerned.
Absolutely. And you know what, Jerry, I just wanted to take the time, and I know that you did want to do the same thing, to just salute him and say, Ari, thank you for bringing a great illumination in the world. And it's been so rewarding to have known such a strong, mighty fighter. And he fought to the very end to save lives, and it just means so much. So just want to make that little tribute. Jerry, thank you so much for mentioning it. Also, hopefully within the next few days, we can actually talk about the significance of the town that he lived in and why it's so important. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix, and we're going to have Dr. Rafael Medoff on the show. So don't go away. We're going to be talking about the rescue of Danish Jews during the Second World War. So we'll be right back after these messages.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Israel News Talk Radio is Beyond the Matrix. We are here, and I just want to remind you that we are sponsored by Torah Learning Channel. It's located at TorahLearningChannel.com. Very easy place to find it on the internet, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Torah Learning for your enjoyment and illumination. Jerry, we have on our show again today a very familiar guest that we've had on several times, Dr. Rafael Medoff. And he has been such so kind as to join us again, because we have a sort of a focus that we want to bring, because it's between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and about a very important date and event that took place really in Jewish history that happened in Europe. Jerry, why don't you go ahead and take it off, and let's start the questions.
That's right, Rod. What we're talking about is the 75th anniversary of the rescue of Danish Jews in October 1943, which started during Rosh Hashanah. Dr. Medoff why was the rescue of Denmark's 7,000 Jews under Nazi occupation so significant?
Well, until that time, October 1943, the Roosevelt administration and its allies had been claiming that it was impossible to rescue any Jews from Hitler. When American Jewish leaders would ask President Roosevelt or a spokesman for the administration to take steps to try to rescue Jewish refugees, the administration would always say that there was nothing that could be done except to win the war. That was their standard argument. That's how the Roosevelt administration fended off requests to help the Jews in Europe during the Holocaust. What the rescue of the Jews of Denmark proved was, in fact, that Jews could be rescued, that there were ways that could be found if there was a will among the Allied leaders to make even a minimal effort to help the Jews in Europe.
Following the news of the rescue of Denmark's Jews, it was a Bergson rally in New York. It can be done, which illuminates your point. What was the message and who were prominently involved in that pageant?
The Bergson Group was a political action committee that was set up in the United States at the beginning of the war by a group of Zionist activists from Palestine and Europe. Their leader was Peter Bergson. His real name was Hillel Cook. And they used a number of protest tactics that were innovative for that time, such as newspaper advertisements and lobbying in Congress to try to get the Roosevelt administration to do something to help the Jews in Europe. So the Bergson Group was kind of a cutting-edge force on the American Jewish scene, and they were challenging the policies of the United States government with regard to rescue and refugees. As soon as news began reaching the West about the rescue of the Jews in Denmark in October 1943, the Bergson Group realized immediately that this could serve as a precedent for more action by the Allied governments to rescue Jews. They realized they could point to the mass escape of more than 7,000 Jews from Denmark as evidence that, in fact, that something could be done, that the claim that the Allies were helpless to rescue the Jews was, in fact, false and was politically motivated. So the Bergson Group sponsored a rally and took out a full-page ad in major American newspapers in the autumn of 1943, newspapers such as the New York Times, which generally buried news about the Holocaust
right.
in its back pages, if it covered it at all. So that's why the Bergson Group was forced to pay for advertisements, because the story that it needed to publicize was not making it into the news pages. Anyway, the headline of the newspaper ad was, "It Can Be Done." And the subheadline reads, "Simply by opening its doors, Sweden saved the Jewish population of nearby Denmark." And it went on, the ad went on to plead with President Roosevelt and the Allies to follow the example of the Danish fishermen who rescued the Jews from Denmark, and the Swedish government, which opened its doors to all of these Jewish refugees. The rally included a number of prominent personalities, prominent figures in the entertainment world, including some names that are still well known today, such as, for example, Orson Welles. Now, the significance of having celebrities like Orson Welles and other stars of stage and screen was that in those days, just like today, the public is always interested in what celebrities have to say. Even when those celebrities are actors and musicians who have no real knowledge or expertise in political affairs, nonetheless, it's the same way today. If a famous actor or other entertainer says something on a issue of contemporary interest, people pay attention. And that was one of the brilliant moves of the Berkson Group. It understood that to reach the American public, you had to use gimmicks of this sort. The mainstream or established Jewish organizations didn't really understand this. They tended to operate according to the their routine ways, the old ways, and not use innovative tactics. So bringing in celebrities was a way to attract attention to an issue that otherwise was not getting the attention deserved, and that was, of course, the mass murder of the Jews in Europe by the Germans.
If I could, just for a second, to just remind those who are listening that this was a real full-court press by country's royalty, the Danish royalty, academia, as you mentioned, the fishing fleet, protecting and transporting these Jews. I mean, there was a full court press going on in Europe. And at the same time, now that we're at the 75th year anniversary of the Bermuda Conference involving the British and the U.S. governments allegedly concerned over the rescue of the Jews caught in the Holocaust, why did it fail to produce any rescue plans? Was this just a big show? What was going on? And maybe you can explain what the 75th, what the Bermuda Conference was about and when it was held so the listener can know.
It was exactly as you say. It was a big show. It was never intended to provide real relief or rescue of the Jewish refugees. It was intended as a public relations gesture. The Bermuda Conference, held in the island of Bermuda, in the spring of 1943, so that's about 6 months before the rescue of the Jews from Denmark. It was deliberately held in a remote island so that Jewish protesters and the news media would not have easy access to the deliberations. The government of the United States and Great Britain decided to hold this conference because there was a growing outcry among activists such as the Berkson Group and others in the Jewish community, and also among some journalists and some members of Congress, an outcry over the failure of the Roosevelt administration to do anything meaningful to help the Jews in Europe. So in response to that outcry, to throw a bone to the critics, the Roosevelt and Churchill governments announced that they would hold this conference in Bermuda where they would discuss behind closed doors ways to help the Jewish refugees. The problem was that neither government had any serious interest in helping the Jews. The United States did not want Jewish refugees coming here. The Churchill government did not want them trying to get into what was then British-ruled Palestine because of local Arab opposition. So both governments went into the Bermuda Conference with the intention of not coming up with anything significant. And again, hiding behind the claim that there was no way to rescue the Jews except to win the war. And that's essentially what emerged. After 12 days of these top secret deliberations, the delegates to the conference emerged. They told the press that that their discussions had to all be kept secret and off the record, so they couldn't discuss any details, but they were looking into a number of different ideas. But then the truth is, they weren't looking into very much at all. And even at the time, Jewish organizations realized that the Bermuda Conference had been essentially a bluff or a hoax. And they were strongly critical of it. And it was in the aftermath of the Bermuda Refugee Conference that the Berkson Group really kicked its public campaign into high gear, placing over 200 full-page newspaper ads in major newspapers around the country, organizing a march by more than 400 rabbis to the White House to plead for rescue.
Right.
And then after the rescue of the Jews from Denmark in October, holding the placing ads about it and holding the rally to which we just referred, which, by the way, took place at Carnegie Hall in Manhattan. So the Berkson Group, very keen to the public relations angle, deliberately chose the highest profile public venues it could find. Some of its events were held at Madison Square Garden. The one, the Danish rescue event was held at Carnegie Hall. Others were held at similar, very high profile venues in order to attract maximum attention to this issue so that the Roosevelt administration would be, in effect, forced by public opinion to stop looking away.
Very good. Dr. Madoff, we're going to have to go to a break. We're going to have another follow-up question that Jerry's going to bring to you. But don't go away, guys. You've been listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. We have Dr. Rafael Madoff, and along with my co-host, Jerry Gordon, we are here on Israel News Talk Radio. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Back from the break, and we're with Jerry Gordon, myself, and Dr. Rafael Madoff, and we want to continue on with our questioning, talking about the 75th anniversary of the rescue of the Danish Jews in October of 1943 during Rosh Hashanah. So we're right during this time, and we figured we'd refresh the story so that you guys can hear what was going on. And when we left off, Dr. Madoff had mentioned that there was a Bermuda conference with British and U.S. government officials, which basically ended up being a big flat nothing burger. Nothing happened. And then he we're starting to talk about what the Jewish community began to do to sort of raise up the ante. So, Jerry, I'm going to knock it over to you.
Well, my comment on that is that it may have been a nothing burger, but Jews died
absolutely
unceremoniously. Dr. Madoff, you've written about contrasting two New York Jewish congressmen concerned with the outcome of the Bermuda Conference, Emanuel or Manny Seller versus Saul Bloom. Who were they, and how did they expose FDR's State and War Department resistance to the rescue of Jews in the Holocaust?
Seller and Bloom represent a very interesting contrast. In some ways, they were, one might say, symbolic of two types of Jewish public officials in those days, maybe today as well. They were both a Democrat congressman from New York City. Bloom was especially powerful because he was chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee for many years. Seller was not as powerful, but he was very prominent, especially as a voice for American Jews. Now, they weren't leaders of Jewish organizations. They were Jews who were members of Congress, but because of their prominence in public life, in some ways they were seen almost as Jewish leaders. Bloom was profoundly loyal to President Roosevelt, the New Deal, and the policies of the administration, including its policies regarding Jewish refugees. So even though the Roosevelt administration took a very hard line in refusing to do anything meaningful for the Jews in Europe, and even though President Roosevelt closed the doors of this country, despite the fact that the immigration quotas were almost never filled, Congressman Bloom loyally defended those policies, and he became known as a Jewish spokesman almost for the administration. Emanuel Seller was quite the opposite. He was forthright in his public criticism of the administration's refugee policy, and this was significant because Seller was a New Deal Democrat, just like Bloom. And he was a very strong supporter of President Roosevelt, except on this issue. And that was a mark of political courage, I would say, that he was willing to break with the president on this important issue, even though he was loyal to the president. Seller was loyal to the president and his policies on every other issue. Batella repeatedly and strongly criticized the administration's refugee policies, and he and Bloom often clashed as a result. And looking back, one can see Bloom and Seller almost as representatives of a certain kind of American Jew. There were those who were very acculturated, or we sometimes say assimilated, like Bloom, who were extremely self-conscious about the fact that they were Jews, never wanted to call attention to Jewish concerns, and would bend over backwards to try to prove that they weren't really concerned about so-called Jewish issues. And then there were those like Emanuel Seller, who were more openly proud of their Jewish identity, who saw nothing wrong with asking the administration to, for example, do something to help Jewish refugees, and who did not shy away from public controversy just because of the fact that there was some anti-Semitism out there. Bloom was very and constantly worried that if Jews protested too loudly, there would be anti-Semitism, even pogroms. He actually warned the aforementioned Peter Bergson at one point that if Bergson continued his public activities of rallies and newspaper ads and so forth, that it would lead to pogroms in the United States, which is obviously ridiculous. It was ridiculous at the time, and it certainly never happened. The Bergson Group continued its high-profile activities, and there were no anti-Semitic outbreaks. But that was a certain type of Jewish personality that feared if Jews raised their heads, then mass anti-Semitism might result. Emanuel Seller was cut from a different cloth. He did not allow himself to be paralyzed by these kinds of fears of anti-Semitism. And as a result, he became a kind of a voice of conscience for the Jewish community on Capitol Hill, again and again, challenging the administration for abandoning the Jews when there were so many things that the administration could have done that would have required minimal effort. Such as, for example, using those unused immigration quotas, or dropping a few bombs on Auschwitz from American planes that were already flying over Auschwitz in 1944, and other steps that could have been taken, but which were not.
During the course of the aftermath of the Bermuda Conference, wasn't there a famous event about what we would call fake statistics on the part of a certain Undersecretary of State, Mr. Breckinridge Long? How did that occur? How did he get found out for lying about statistics regarding the ability to save Jews?
Well, the Bergson Group at a certain point became convinced that the only way to rescue Jews would be to create an entirely new government agency whose only purpose was to help refugees. They wanted to take the whole refugee issue out of the hands of the State Department and put it and make it the responsibility of a new government agency. To promote this proposal, they organized what has now become the famous march by more than 400 rabbis to the gates of the White House just before Yom Kippur in 1943. And the rabbis appeared at the White House with a petition calling on President Roosevelt to create this new rescue agency. As we know, the president refused to see the rabbis. In fact, he left the White House for a rear exit in order to avoid having any contact with them, and refused to meet with them even though his schedule was wide open that afternoon. Anyway, as a result of that march and all the publicity that ensued from it, the Bergson Group was able to persuade some members of Congress to introduce a resolution calling on the president to create a rescue agency. Sol Bloom tried to block the resolution. Acting on behalf of the administration, he insisted that there would have to be full hearings on this measure. It was known as the Gillette Rogers resolution. The full hearings, Bloom thought, would give the administration an opportunity to knock out the support for the resolution. So the administration sent Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, who was the main official at the State Department in charge of Jewish matters. They sent him to the hearings, to Bloom's hearings, to testify about the resolution. And meeting behind closed doors without the press present, Long proceeded to make the argument that there was no need for a rescue agency because the U.S. government was already doing everything possible to help the Jews, and he claimed that the government had already taken in 580,000 Jewish refugees since the rise of Hitler in 1933.
A real quick question. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead and finish.
Because it was held behind closed doors, the news media did not at first hear this claim about the 580,000. But here was the ironic twist which resulted in this news becoming public. When Long finished his testimony, the members of the committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, agreed by a large majority that they did not want to pass this resolution. They agreed with the administration's opposition to creating a rescue agency. But they didn't want to simply vote against the resolution because they were afraid it would be seen as cruel, anti-humanitarian to be opposed to rescue. So what they did is they shelved the resolution without a vote, and they asked Long for special permission to make his testimony public so that they would be able to explain to the news media and the Jewish community why they had shelved the resolution. Long thought that was a fine idea, and he authorized it. They released the testimony. When they released the testimony, then it was immediately Jewish organizations and journalists saw that Long had lied. Now, let me just mention that Long's testimony about the 580,000 refugees who were supposedly admitted made the front page of the New York Times, top of the fold. It was one of the very few times during the entire Nazi period that the New York Times ever put anything on its front page about the Jews. And so the story they chose to put on the front page was the false claim that Roosevelt already had rescued so many Jews. However, reporters for other publications, such as The New Republic, The Nation, PM, which was a daily newspaper in New York City, they immediately exposed the fact that the 580,000 number was a lie. And when I say a lie, what I mean is this. 580,000 was actually the number of immigration visas that could have been issued during that entire period if the administration had chosen to. But in fact, the actual number of visas that were issued and people that came was less than half that number. And not all of them were Jewish, because we're talking here about visas from all over the world. So the number who received visas and came was far, far smaller than what Long had claimed. And it was that expose of Long's fabricated statistics that then gave the whole movement for rescue a huge boost. So ironically, the whole thing backfired. An attempt by Roosevelt to kill the resolution ended up giving it a renewed life.
That is an amazing, testimony to the shenanigans that goes on in governments all the time, even to this day. We're at the end of this segment, so we're going to have to go to a break. Guys, stick around. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Thank you for sticking around for the break. I'm Rod Bryant, along with Jerry Gordon. We have a very special guest, Dr. Raphael Medoff. And we're talking about the rescue of Danish Jews in 1943, the attempted rescue, and also some of the other countries, for example, Bulgaria, even though it was a Nazi ally at the time, tend to have a large number of Jews that survived the war, despite all of the other pressures that the German government was putting on them. Jerry, why don't you go off and let's ask this next question that you wanted to ask.
Dr. Medoff, we just talked about the failure of the Gillette Rogers proposal to establish a war rescue organization that was basically turned down by FDR. How did the War Rescue Board come about? And how many Jews did it save? And in particular, what efforts did it launch in Hungary that saved the remnants of Hungarian Jews?
President Roosevelt did not want to establish a government rescue agency, as Jewish activists and members of Congress were demanding. He did not want to expend even the most minimal resources helping Jewish refugees. But what happened is that as a result of the controversy over Breckinridge Long's testimony, which we just discussed, the matter of the administration's failure to rescue became public information. It became something of a scandal. Major Jewish organizations, which usually were hesitant to challenge the president, came out publicly denouncing Long's attempt to misrepresent U.S. policy. And the pressure to create this rescue agency grew, even though the administration had been doing its best to block the resolution calling for a rescue agency. By early 1944, it was developing into a political problem for the president, because 1944 was, of course, a presidential election year. And no president, including FDR, can ever be certain that they have re-election locked up. So the fact that Jews were a major block of voters in New York, and New York was the largest electoral state in a presidential race, was something that was very much on President Roosevelt's mind. In early 1944, officials of the Treasury Department, led by Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, came to President Roosevelt with documented evidence of how the State Department had been suppressing news about the mass murders and sabotaging opportunities to rescue refugees. Morgenthau warned Roosevelt, in effect, that if he did not do something, such as create a new agency, that it would mushroom into a major political scandal in an election year, and it could be a political disaster. Roosevelt was certainly a savvy politician. He realized that the best way to get out of this mess was to go ahead and do what Congress wanted. So even though Congress never passed that resolution, Roosevelt went ahead and established the War Refugee Board by executive order. Now, he never meant the War Refugee Board to be anything more than an election year gesture. So he gave it almost no funding. Other government agencies like the State Department and the War Department rarely cooperated with it. The White House itself was not particularly helpful. But the War Refugee Board was staffed by a handful of brilliant and courageous young lawyers from the Treasury Department, none of them Jews, by the way, who use all sorts of unorthodox and innovative methods during the last 15 months of the war to rescue Jews. Even though for the previous 4 years, the president had been insisting there was no way to rescue Jews. But sure enough, just as the Bergson Group had imagined, once there was a will, ways could be found. So even though they had a tiny budget and a small staff, few resources, little cooperation from other agencies, the men and women of the War Refugee Board accomplished near miracles during the final months of the war. Historians calculated altogether the board rescued, played an important role in rescuing more than 200,000 refugees. They did this by sending funds to Europe to bribe Nazis, to help the underground groups shelter Jews, to move Jewish refugees out of the way of retreating German armies that would have massacred them. And most famously, it was the War Refugee Board which convinced the young Swede, Raoul Wallenberg, to go to Nazi-occupied Budapest in 1944 and to rescue Jews there, including, in some cases, pulling them off trains from which they were about to be deported to Auschwitz. So Wallenberg's heroism was something that could not have been accomplished without the War Refugee Board. Now, not all of the War Refugee Board's proposals went very far. In some cases, they were failures. For example, they wanted to set up temporary havens for refugees in America, bring over hundreds of thousands of Jews who escaped the Nazis and let them stay here just temporarily during the war. But President Roosevelt agreed to accept only one tiny group of 982 refugees. Another important proposal that the War Refugee Board promoted but which was not acted upon was to bomb the railway lines and bridges leading to Auschwitz or to bomb the gas chambers and crematory itself. The reason that proposal was feasible was because by the summer of 1944, the Allies controlled the skies over Europe, and Allied planes, American and British planes, were regularly bombing in and around Auschwitz anyway, because there were German oil factories that were set up in the slave labor section of Auschwitz, where, by the way, teenage Elie Wiesel was a prisoner. And the Allies were bombing those oil factories anyway, so to drop a few bombs on the gas chambers or on the railways leading to the camp obviously would have required very minimal effort. So that was a proposal which clearly could have been done, but the administration refused, and they refused it on specious grounds. They claimed that it was impractical because they would have to divert planes from the war effort to carry out such missions. But as I've noted, no such diversion would have been necessary because the planes were already flying over that area.
Dr. Medoff, you've been critical of this current exhibit about FDR and Jews during the war, and in particular the comments of the curator, who basically indicated that the effort to bomb the camps, to bomb the approaches to it, would not have spared a number of people. And yet, as you just pointed out, we were bombing essentially the killing center at Auschwitz-Birkenau virtually every day to eliminate the artificial rubber and oil plants. Why, even at this late date, are people whitewashing FDR's legacy?
There are, unfortunately, a handful, a small handful of historians whose interpretations of the episodes that we're discussing are based on something other than the actual historical facts. And I can't speak to their motives. All I can tell you is that the exhibit that we're talking about, which is called Americans and the Holocaust, marks the first time that the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington has taken on the issue of America's response to the Nazi genocide, and they've done a very poor job of it. And by poor job, what I mean is that the running theme of the exhibit is that there was very little the United States could have done to rescue anybody, and President Roosevelt should not be criticized for abandoning the Jews because he did the best he could. And after all, it was a war, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism, and there were lots of other reasons why really nothing could have been done. The tragedy of seeing the U.S. Holocaust Museum make such arguments is that these were exactly the arguments that were made by the State Department and the White House in 1942 or 1943. And these arguments were exposed as false at the time. And that's why, in the end, some Jews were rescued thanks to the War Refugee Board, precisely because the old claim of nothing can be done was proven to be a myth. So it's sad that one of the curators of the exhibit, Dr. Rebecca Erbelding, has been giving interviews in which she has claimed, for example, that bombing Auschwitz or the railways leading to it would not have helped anybody, and it wouldn't have made any difference, and there's no point in complaining about it now. And her argument was essentially that, well, the Germans could always repair railways and bridges. Now, of course, they could repair railways and bridges, but that never stopped the Allies from bombing many, many railways and bridges. That's what happens during wartime. And bridges, by the way, took a lot longer to repair than railways. And the bridges were a key part of the route over which hundreds of thousands of Jews were deported to Auschwitz in the spring and summer of 1944. Had the Allies dropped a few bombs and disrupted those transportation lines, there would have at least been some delay, some interruption of the mass murder process. And I need not remind you that at its peak, 12,000 Jews were being gassed every single day in Auschwitz. So even a brief interruption, even a few days interruption, would have meant the saving of many lives. And I'm not impressed by those like Dr. Erbelding who claim that, well, most of the Jews were dead by then anyway, so it doesn't matter. Many Jews were not dead by then. The Jews of Hungary were not dead by then. And the interruption of the mass murder of the Jews of Hungary would have been very significant, even if it did not involve the majority of Jews in Europe. The argument that since we can't rescue everybody, there's no point in rescuing anybody, is really not a very persuasive argument. It was not persuasive in the 1940s, and frankly, it's not persuasive in modern times either. We've seen contemporary presidents claim, for example, about the Darfur genocide, that, well, we can't really do too much about it. We can't, you know, we can't really stop the whole thing, so there's no point.
Doing anything about it. So, look, the argument just doesn't wash any way that you look at it. Dr. Madoff, we're just completely out of time. We're going to have to go. Thank you so much for joining us on Beyond the Matrix. You've been listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Don't fail to come back next week, same time, same place. See you later. Shalom.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.